Well, hello. Thank you for being here, and I'm hoping I'll be able to make justice to this wonderful field of medical entomology. As it has been mentioned, this is going to reflect who I am, and so some of you are going to feel that, this is not my medical entomology, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to make it interesting. And to start with, there are many diseases that are transmitted by insects and mites and others. And so one way to sort of try to make some sense out of it is to look across multiple diseases and try to make a summary and find correlations. And this year, in 2008, there has been a summary that was done by Jones et al. That summarized all new emerging events, disease events, EIDs, emerging infectious diseases. And they, sort of by just looking at it, they found that there seems to be a pattern that most of the diseases are actually showing up at high latitudes or low latitudes, sort of temperate regions. And they were trying to understand why that was. And they found, they did an analysis, they looked at 335 EID events between 1940 and 2004. And this is sort of, in a way, there was a bit controversial because they made some new definitions of what they consider to be an infectious disease. So they included bacterial strains of species, quote unquote, that already were present but that were occurred because of a drug resistance. And so that meant that this analysis has many more bacteria as considered to be new EIDs than others have done in the past. But they separated all their diseases into zoonotic, meaning things that came from wildlife. I'm trying to decide what's the best way. Meaning things that have come from wildlife, for example, Ebola virus. Zoonotic non-wildlife, for example, flu virus, influenza virus from chickens, bird flu. Drug resistance, which turned out to be a very large group in their new definition, and then vector-borne diseases. And what they did was also trying to understand in what way reporting bias might be changing the sort of influencing the distribution of the cases that you're seeing here. So they actually used a journal, and I'll go into that into more detail. So they looked at all these diseases, and they try to correlate them with human density, human growth patterns, increases in number of people, latitude, rainfall, and wildlife host richness. And then they also looked at the number of, so the source of the authors of the papers in JID, Journal of Infectious Diseases. And they tried to use that as a way to control for, in the United States, maybe easier to be doing studies right here, maybe able to find more infectious diseases because you can just find it in your backyard. So they tried to use that as a way to control for reporting bias. And so what they found, sort of in summary, so there's a summary here of the number of, trying to do this both ways. So separating between elements, fungi, protozoa, viruses, and prions, and then bacteria or rickettsia or rickettsia bacteria, depending on definition. And again, the bacteria came out as in a very high proportion of the cases, more than in other cases, other studies. And they, because as I said, they included all the drug resistance strains. And they found that there was an increase over time since 1940 with a peak in the 1980s that seems to be related to the big epidemic of AIDS that has created a large population of susceptible people, more susceptible people. So if you look at sort of separation between zoonotic and all these, the four categories, you still find an increase over time. As I said, the drug-resistant cases are increasing over time with a big peak in the 1980s. And then if you look at vector-borne disease, that is one of the cases where there's a clear increase over time. Vector-borne diseases are responsible for about 23% of the EID events. In the last decade, almost 30%. And there is a significant rise over time for the vector-borne diseases, which is not true for many of the other categories. Now, while they found clear correlations between reports, so there was definitely a reporting bias, but if you take that out, they found that there was a worldwide correlation for all four categories with population numbers. So the density of people clearly influences the occurrence of new infectious diseases. On the other hand, certain cases, for example, the drug-resistant bacteria were clearly associated with both population growth and latitude because they seem to mostly occur in the developed countries. Because you can easily argue that that's because of the much, much higher increase of antibacterials that are being used in developed countries. And so all these four categories, you could find associations with these different parameters, except for vector-borne diseases that really did not have any association except, as I said, human population density. There was not associated with anything else. And if you sort of look at their graph separately, so this is, whoops. This is the wildlife events. So these are the non-wildlife events, very accumulating on the high latitude and low latitude. The drug-resistant events, same thing. While the vector-borne disease seems to be a much more dispersed kind of occurrence, it seems much more dispersed. It doesn't seem to be a latitude pattern at all. Number of people is certainly an important parameter, but not many other things, which in the paper, the authors were trying to come up with ways in which they could make predictions about where the next diseases should come in. And you can do that for some extent in some of the other three categories, but that was very hard to do, although it didn't stop them, but it was very hard to do that for vector-borne diseases. Now, if you notice here, there are sort of the two cases that have been more in the news this year. It's been the West Nile virus introduction into the U.S., and also West Nile virus introduction in first found in New York, and then Lyme disease. Now, for West Nile virus, there's a wonderful review article that just came out by Laura Kramer, Linda Steyer, and Greg Ebel. Just came out in Annual Review. It's a very nice summary of the summary of not only what has happened with West Nile since it got here, it looks at it a bit across the world, and also some of the very interesting research being done on passaging of the parasite, both on the vectors and on vertebrate hosts. So it was a very nice summary. Now, I'm going to look into the Lyme disease example, because there was an interesting paper that came out this year on the comparison between Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, in Europe and in the United States. Now, Borrelia burgdorferi is a spirochete. It's transmitted by hard-bodied ticks. It is the main agent. It is the agent of Lyme disease. And this is the most important vector-borne disease, of course, important meaning number of cases in this case. Over 20,000 annual reported cases of Lyme disease in the United States. Mostly in 10 states, and I'm from New Jersey, and it's a major problem in New Jersey. Now, there are approximately 12 outer surface proteins, and I'm not going to go into the details, the molecular details of the parasite, but there's surface proteins, there's several, and this particular OSP, outer surface protein C, there are about 12 types, but only four of them are strongly associated to human disease, meaning that when you find somebody sick, the particular surface proteins are either type A, B, I, or K, although there's a few exceptions. But predominantly, these are the four. Now, if you look in between U.S. and Europe, there's a lot of sharing of common genotypes. And so because in the United States there's a higher genetic diversity, it was thought that Lyme disease was really a U.S. disease that has increased since the 1970s in number because people have been sort of encroaching on the habitat of ticks. We also have had increases in the numbers of deer. And so it's basically a habitat environmental consequence that has led to this emerging infectious disease. Well, what the authors of this paper did was they actually looked at the historic relationships, the phylogeny of the populations of Borrelia burgdorferi in the U.S. and in Europe using loci that are not under diversifying selection. So previous studies have looked at the OSPC in itself and a few other loci, which are itself under selection since it's one of the things that the immune system is going to be targeting. So they looked at loci that are not under diversifying selection. And what they found was quite surprising. They found that, for example, OSPC B, which was thought to be shared between Europe and USA, is actually quite different. So what this is a concatenated tree using six housekeeping genes. And then on top of that, but not being used to create the tree, are the OSPC group alleles. So this is OSPC A, OSPC B1, B2. Now, what they found was that B in Europe, which is red, they called it B2 because the underground genetic diversity based on the housekeeping genes indicates they're really quite different beasts from the B1 in USA. So blue is in USA and red is Europe. However, OSPC A they found was, in fact, quite closely related between Europe and the USA. And these six housekeeping genes encompass about 11,000 base pairs. So it's a very large amount of data they're using to create this. So what they then found was that, but again, if you just look at this, you really can't tell. You know that there's been a movement of bugs with OspCA alleles on them that must have been moved between Europe and USA, but you could agree it's really kind of hard to tell which way it went. However, if you look at the phylogeny of sort of a deeper phylogeny of Borrelia, they actually included other species, Borrelia bissetii, which is considered to be the most closely related species to Burgdorferi. And what they found, and then they just did a survey in Europe, they found new genospecies from Europe. So what they're arguing here is that Europe may be the ancestral land of Borrelia burgdorferi, and that in fact the introduction may have happened from Europe into the U.S. And the interesting thing about that is that they also then looked at those 11,000 base pairs and found that there's really no genetic difference between the OspCA in Europe and in the United States, and calculated that the introduction would have had to have happened less than 200 years ago. It could have happened in 1970. So if indeed Europe is the original land of Borrelia burgdorferi, then that would explain why there was a big increase in Lyme disease in the United States. Not because of people and the environment, oh, I'm sure that has something to do with it, but because a new strain was introduced into the United States. Now another interesting, very interesting paper on ticks, and I'm not a tick person, so I'm kind of having fun with understanding all of this, was published in Vector-Borne Zoonotic Diseases by Epperson et al. And this is a very different kind of disease, it's not that different kind of disease, different story. The agent of Rocky Mountain spotted fever is Rickettsiae, which is, since 2000, the number of cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever is thought to have increased tenfold in North Carolina. That's an emerging disease right there. And the main vector of Rocky Mountain spotted fever is Dermacentor variabilis, so the American dog tick. So what Epperson et al. Did was they looked in North Carolina, and actually in Chatham County, and they looked at they sampled ticks in suburban North Carolina. They did immunofluorescent antibody tests on human sera, so they collaborated with local clinics and looked at human sera for presumptive cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and they also did the same tests on the blood from local deer. What they found was that instead of finding a lot of American dog ticks, they found a lot of the Lone Star ticks. Amblyomma americanum was a very aggressive, and it was basically the tick found in all the houses they sampled. And these ticks were infected with a variant, Rickettsian amblyommae, that was actually described by Burgdorfer in 1981, but was thought to really not be much of a disease. I mean, it could create some. It was definitely something that could be transmitted, but did not seem to have any clinical cases. Well, that seems to have changed. They found also that Rickettsiae, the agent of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, was very rare, and in six cases that they were actually able to have both. Were able to follow up. They found that three of those human cases appeared to be due to Rickettsia amblyommae. So the immune antibody fluoresced much, much stronger with amblyommae than it did with Rickettsia rickettsii. So Per Epperson concluded that possibly changes in human use of the environment, the fact that there's now all these developments in areas where Lone Star tick has become a very aggressive and very common vector, and that Rickettsia amblyommae seems to have very increased and possibly, and this has not been done yet, possibly mutated or changed in some way that is now creating symptoms very similar to Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Now, the interesting thing that is not on the slide is that they, as I said, they tested also local deer, and local deer are considered to be the main providers of blood to the Lone Star tick, but they never found Rickettsia amblyommae in the deer. So they did not really find a vertebrate host for Rickettsia amblyommae, maybe just being transmitted vertically between the Lone Star ticks. All right, so we sort of have two examples of two diseases, one that possibly was basically moved across the pond, the other one that seems to be the response from increasing populations. And so there's been a lot of effort into trying to make predictions of vector-borne disease risk, not just when's the next emerging one coming in, but just, you know, even the ones we have, how can we predict how bad the year is going to be, where is the disease going to be showing up, and when should we be worried about it becoming from endemic, epidemic. So I'm not going to go into details, but there's some wonderful models that John Day and Shaman has kind of put together over time. And in this particular paper, they were trying to do real time and helping, working with the local health department to try to make predictions about is this going to be a bad year or not. And so they have some interesting connection between the water table level, which has to do with the amount of humidity in the environment and basically survivorship of the mosquitoes. And they've been able to make some very suggestive correlations between St. Louis encephalitis outbreaks, epidemic outbreaks, and that particular hydrological predictor. And so in this paper, they're sort of describing how they were trying to do a real-time analysis. And in both cases, in 2004 and 2005, kind of, it all looked like it was going to be epidemic, and then it just something changed, and it didn't happen. There were still cases of it. This was for West Nile virus. Now, another interesting paper is a review by Eisen and Eisen, where they're trying to sort of compare and contrast doing epidemiological models, which use reported disease cases, and vector abundance models. A lot of sort of interesting descriptions and summaries of how you really have to work with local vector control and health departments to obtain all the information, how hard that is to do, how, you know, if everything was wonderful, we might be able to make good predictions, and so some of the good and bad things about the different kinds of models. But really, a sort of an elephant in the room kind of thing is, what is the relationship between infected vectors and actual transmission? And there's a paper that has the nicest and the least provocative title you can think of, which is a arbovirus transmission by Culex nigripalpus in Florida by Vitek, Richards, and Moores, and Day, and Cynthia Lord, which ends up, they really were looking for, they were looking at the number of the activity, the relationship between different mosquitoes, in particular Culex nigripalpus, and West Nile virus activity. They had three field sites in Florida where they had previous West Nile virus activity. I mean, they used four chicken baited lard traps for field site weekly collections. So this kind of trap, you basically have the trap and the chicken is right there. And so you're going to be able to see if the chicken is infected, and then you're going to know if the mosquitoes that were there with the chicken were infected or not. Now the critical result is that they have, so these are collection dates, field sites, total number of mosquitoes, number of traps, all the, in these cases the species positives were nigripalpus, this is the size of the pool. And the question here is, were the mosquitoes that were inside in these traps blood fed or not? And in all cases except one, the mosquitoes that were in the trap were blood fed, which meant they had bitten the chicken that was in there with them. And they actually did some control analysis showing that, in fact, if there were no chickens in there, the likelihood of a mosquito being blood fed would be very low. And I know that. I've been trying to get blood in mosquitoes for a while. It's hard to get. So all of these mosquitoes were blood fed, but the chickens, only one out of eight was actually positive. What that means is that a bite from an infected vector does not mean disease transmission will happen. And I don't know about you, but to me that rocks my world. I mean, I was hoping that if you could look at the number of infected mosquitoes, you could have some sort of idea of how transmission is going to happen. So what are the things that influence that? What's the likelihood that an infected vector will be able to transmit the disease? And this year there have been multiple papers that have looked at things that affect the ability of a vector to transmit a disease once it's infected, or in some cases actually becoming infected. But one of them is this paper by Kilpatrick et al. That looked at the effect of temperature, viral genetics, because this is West Nile virus, and we know there has been a shift in the main genetic strain, genetic type of the West Nile in the United States. And they found that both viral genetics and temperature had a big effect on the sort of transmissibility. So once the mosquito is infected, how fast it will actually become able to transmit the disease. And then this is another very interesting paper that sort of came out of the blue. I was looking at it in sort of immunology and the effect of the vector immune system on disease transmission. This paper is a paper on the Toll pathway, an immune system pathway to control dengue virus infection. And what they actually found was that the presence of gut flora, so the bacteria that are just commonly showing up in the floor, in the gut of mosquitoes, affects, it basically primes the immune system of a mosquito. So if you have a mosquito that is coming from an area where there's a lot of bacteria, they'll have a lower rate of dissemination of the virus once the mosquito becomes infected. And now here, these are two other papers, interesting analysis, looking at both a pathogen, Borrelia burgdorferi, and how it actually changes host-finding efficacy. And this was one other one, which I just thought needed to be mentioned, of microsporidiosis and how it alters the blood feeding responses and deep repellency in Aedes aegypti. So sort of in summary, it seems that temperature, pathogen strain, and other pathogenic or harmless members of the vector's inner life seem to affect the ability that once a vector is infected, it will actually be able to transmit the disease. And then there's another set of papers, and this is kind of a personal thing, but a set of papers came out just very recently, like looked at lateral gene transfer between Wolbachia rickettsia, bacteria, Wolbachia, and insects. And what they actually found, these papers just came out, this actually started a few years ago, but this year we had a paper that looked at multiple species and actually found evidence of actually lateral gene transfer. Now, lateral gene transfer is something that we know is very well established in the movement of genes between bacteria and other prokaryotes. But this is an example, and a very rare example, of lateral gene transfer between a prokaryote and an eukaryote, and how it may change. So basically, sort of Culex quinquefasciatus may be borrowing genes from Wolbachia parasites and maybe changing its capacity to transmit, become infected and transmit a disease. Another very interesting review is sort of a general horizontal gene transfer in eukaryotic evolution. And finally, sort of a very interesting paper on Wolbachia. This is actually looking at Wolbachia integration. Parts of the genome of Wolbachia has been integrated into an insect chromosome. In particular, this is the bean beetle. And part of the genome of Wolbachia has been inserted into the chromosome X right next to the centromere. And they actually looked at, there's about 54 genes. They mostly show that they become sort of pseudogenes. They start mutating like crazy, and they don't seem to be having any particular function. But the possibility that a eukaryote could borrow a useful gene from a bacteria is sort of tantalizing. The other thing they also found was that there were differences across populations of a particular species of this bean beetle on the presence of particular pieces of Wolbachia. And that affects me a lot. I'm as a population geneticist. So I have to go and sort of start, in fact, we've already started looking at this. Now, not to something completely different, still looking at the impact of what changes the ability of a vector to transmit a disease. There's interesting papers by Alt et al. Where they looked at the larval competition as a way to change the susceptibility of adult Aedes mosquitoes to dengue infection. And what they did was to look at, they had several treatments. They had a treatment where they had, competing Albopictus with Aegypti. Albopictus are the circles, Aegypti are the squares. In this case, they have 160 Albopictus and 160 Aegypti. In this case, they have 320 Albopictus and 0 Aegypti. In this case, 0 Albopictus and 320 Aegypti. 160, 160 again, but looking at the, in this case, looking at Aegypti. So the circles are Albopictus and the squares are Aegypti. And then you have the low density, 160, 0, and 0, 160. So if you look at time of emergence and size at emergence, the higher competition environments up here, where you have 320 mosquitoes, the larvae take longer to emerge, and when they emerge, they're smaller. And that's statistically different. So the A's in here are statistically different for Albopictus from the B. They did not find a statistically significant effect for Aegypti. Now, if you take that and look at the proportion that have an infection and the proportion that have a disseminated infection, they find that the statistically significant for Albopictus, that the mosquitoes that were in high competition environments not only have a higher proportion of infection, but also a higher proportion of disseminated infections, meaning that competition, sort of the ecological ancestry, the larval stages of mosquitoes, and possibly other vectors, affects their ability later to transmit a disease. And there's actually there's a follow-up paper where they basically took this data and looked at within. So they're just looking at the size of the mosquitoes. So this is size and infection status. So these are uninfected, infected but not disseminated, and disseminated infections. And so the mosquitoes that have disseminated infections are statistically significantly smaller than those that were uninfected. So again, a strong connection between ecological ancestry and then disease transmission. Now, besides sort of the changes that what the paper showing the differences in or what changes ability to become an infectious agent, there were also several papers that came out this year on new insecticides and repellents and new methods of control. Some of these are sort of follow up on papers that came out in 2007. This is an interesting sort of overview, a modeling effort looking at mostly in the malaria system where they've been doing transgenic modifications of mosquitoes. This is following up on a paper that came out, I believe, in Nature by Marcelo Lorena group, showing that transgenic mosquito did not really have a very did not have a lower fitness than a non-transgenic mosquito when fed on infected blood meals. So these guys really sort of took that sort of decided to model the importance of the advantages versus the disadvantages and ended up providing a sort of a nice summary of the entire field. Meanwhile, actually, and I don't have it here, Marcelo Lorena does have a new paper just come out again this year showing that in sort of normal circumstances, these transgenic mosquitoes definitely have lower fitness, and so they're going to have to come up with some driving agent to be able to, if we're going to go on with this, to be able to disperse transgenic mosquitoes successfully in the environment. Another very interesting paper by a group in Scott O'Neill's lab looking at modifying insect population structure to control vector-borne disease. And this is in a follow-up of an analysis they've done where they've been able to look at enzyme expression as a way to look at age of mosquitoes. So they've come up with a methodology, and this is a paper from last year, they come up with a methodology to be able to age mosquitoes, and now they're proposing ways of modifying the insect population structure as a way to control diseases. This is another paper that I thought I loved for two reasons. One, because they're actually using dimethicone, which is a very, very common chemical used in creams. This is my hand cream. I was checking it the other day. And there are two things I like about this study. One is they're comparing the efficiency of this dimethicone, which is something that suffocates the head lice. And it's very well, it doesn't have a smell, it's, as I said, it's used in already, it's something we interact with, you know, almost every day. And they're comparing the use of this chemical to the use of pyrethroids, and they found that the dimethicone was a very successful way to control head lice. The other thing I like about this study is that they actually took 145 kids from a favela in Brazil, in Fortaleza, which is like a really run-down, you know, very poor kids, and they put them all into a resort, a holiday resort, because they were worried about reinfection rates. And so I just love it as a sort of a field study, to sort of the idea of having these kids, 4 to 14, being part of the study in a holiday resort. But it seems the methicone seems to be working quite well for head lice. Another new thing that came out also this year, looking at the Bayou-D, which is a derivative of tomatoes, as an efficacious alternative to DEET. And finally, a paper looking at topically applied Aedes aegypti, I can't remember what this stands for now. I'll be there in a second because we're going to be talking about this paper. It's a inhibitor of apoptosis in Aedes aegypti. So what they looked at was, and this is sort of a proof of concept paper, they looked at targeting an inhibitor of apoptosis, which is cell death, by using RNA interference. This is a methodology that has been used actually quite successfully in more medical, more sort of human medical fields. And the idea here is to try to see if you could develop a methodology where you can actually broadcast an insecticide, a DNA insecticide, to kill mosquitoes. The RNA interference is a system where you basically do selective destruction of messenger RNA by interrupting the production of specific proteins by simply introducing into the organism double-stranded RNA that ends up sort of covering the messenger RNA and preventing it from creating the protein. And so the idea here was to use topical application of, and there were three segments of double-stranded RNA from the it is aegypti inhibitor of apoptosis gene, and the product was diluted in acetone and simply dropped as a little drop on the thorax of mosquitoes. So they looked at, as I said, three different pieces of the locus. They also looked at, they used double-stranded RNA from a chitin protein, and then actually used all three together, and they used acetone on its own. So acetone and acetone plus just the chitin gene didn't do anything. So this is mortality at 3 hours, 12 hours, and 24 hours. Acetone with any of the three pieces of the locus had some effect. And then the three combined ones, there was also mortality. So there was definitely an effect, a significant mortality attributable to the intervention. But the question really is, was there really, is that because of something else? Was there a decrease in this inhibitor apoptosis protein? So they actually did look at the decreased levels, and sure enough, so this is actually, in this case, they used acetone, and they also used CyQuest, which is just another delivery agent. It's simply a liquid. And they found that indeed the levels, the expression levels using quantitative PCR of the actual protein decreased with the application of the solution. So they found that yes, mortality did match quite well the inverse of the levels of expression of the protein. So this is a pretty exciting method, and I'm really curious to see how it's going to develop. Now going to something completely different again. There was a symposium on mosquitoes and plants in Orlando, Florida last year, and I'm just going to take this from the Foster paper, this on phytochemicals and population sampling lures. So phytochemical attractants are used by mosquitoes to locate sugar meals. The nice thing about using this, and plant sugar is fundamental nutrient and is used by recently occluded specimens, so they just come out of the water, to give you information on larval sites. They're used by males. They're used by females preparing to enter diapause, which I think is a very important component. And again, they're used by females in all gonotrophic stages. So instead of trying to attract the mosquitoes with some sort of human or vertebrate lure, you can basically just try to collect them when they're coming to go for a sugar meal. So the use of traps baited with phytochemicals should provide a more species-specific capture compared to light traps, for example, which also collect all of these, and also applicable to day-biting species. Now, obstacles are, you can have shifts in flowering species availability, you can have identification and purification of phytochemicals can be difficult to do. But here's a really cool example. These guys in Israel did a study where they used traps baited with cut flower branches, and they had about 26 species. This was done in an area that was near a sewage treatment plant, so there really wasn't many plants around. They used these 26 species, and they found that Tamarix jordanus, it's actually been introduced into the United States, or at least tamarix, because I've been introduced into the United States, and they're called salt cedars, corresponded about, they collected about 61% of the these Aculix pipiens were collected on with salt cedar. They've also done, so the salt cedar has these little flowers, they have a lot of nectar, a lot of sugar. Then they decided to do this the same, trying to look at the same question but in a different way. And what they did is that they actually used the actual trees, the actual flowers, and they were sprayed with a mixture of sugar solution and 13 food dyes, a different color for different plant species. And what they found is, yet again, so here's the different species of plants. These are labeled females and labeled males. So you can actually take the mosquito, put it under a dissecting microscope, and just look at the color. And they found that about 65% of them had, again, fed on tamarisk and salt cedar. And just to push it in just a little bit more, they applied 20% sucrose solution with a blue food dye and spinosad. And they found that a decrease of 80% on the population. This is when they applied the sucrose solution with the insecticide, and this is a control site, and this is the treated site. This is females and this is males. So sort of an exciting possibility for mosquito control and mosquito attraction. So for studies. Now there are continuing expansions of mosquitoes. Japonicus is now in 27 states. Interesting, sort of summarizes a little bit and has the newest record of Japan, in this case in Illinois. Culex coronator is moving north, some connection possibly with global warming. And then Aedes albopictus is now all over Africa. And the first record of albopictus in Gabon. And then this is a paper that summarizes an interesting, summarizes the, and sort of speculates on the consequences of this, the dengue and chikungunya. Now, albopictus is sort of all over the place. This is a mosquito that is originally from Southeast Asia. In the 16th century, probably Arab pirates may have introduced it into Madagascar. But in the 1890s, it was already in Hawaii. And then recently, it has been expanding. 1979, Albania. In the United States, 1985. Brazil, 1985. 1989, South Africa. 1991, Nigeria. 2002, in the Torres Strait. So it's not yet in Australia. It's also not in New Zealand, although multiple people have said they are. They aren't. They've been collected and destroyed, so there is no population yet in New Zealand. And now 2007 in Gabon. There's a chikungunya fever outbreak that has been historic. I mean, chikungunya has been around for a while. It's mostly a Eastern African disease transmitted by jungle Aedes and some extent in urban areas by Aegypti, but never a very big deal. But since it has jumped into, since it has jumped into albopictus, things have really taken a different turn of events. So in 2007, Vazale et al. In a PLOS paper had shown that there were actually two different dengue now. There were two different strains of chikungunya, of chikv. And there was basically one base pair mutation that seems to be doing all this. And so Tsetsarin et al. In Stephen Higgs' lab done an elegant experiment looking at the effect of a single mutation in chikungunya virus affecting vector specificity. It's a very elegant analysis because they basically took a form of chikungunya virus that had the mutation and they put it back into the previous form. So there's a mutation, alanine to valine at position 229 in the envelope gene 1. And they basically created two different strains that had, this is the strain that originally had, was the mutated valine strain, and they mutated it back to the wild type. And in this case, they took one that was the wild type and mutated it to the valine position. And in both cases, they showed that for albopictus, there's an increased capability of both of infection. But that was not true with Aegypti. So albopictus, the two strains have a very different ability to infect albopictus, while it makes no difference for Aegypti. So there's an increased ability to infect albopictus, but not Aegypti. They've also done studies sort of following the same analysis, looking at the dissemination. They also found that the new mutation was able to disseminate much faster in albopictus, but not in Aegypti. And this is just looking at the salivary gland positivity for chikungunya. So what then in Lamberly et al. In 2008 did was take the entire RNA sequence for the virus and create a phylogeny of chikungunya strains based on the complete on the sequence. And what they've actually found was that, so that little V thing that you're seeing here is that mutation. So these are the locations where you have the valine mutation. And what they found was that the E1226V mutation has occurred three times independently. Well, that's a huge, enormous big deal, because the only time that this kind of rate of evolution has been found has been in things like influenza virus or AIDS virus under retroviral treatment. This is a chikungunya virus being suddenly pushed into having to be transmitted by albopictus, and three times independently has been able to do so, and very effectively. So the bad news. Vector-borne diseases are on the rise. Movements of vectors and pathogens are important to this rise, and they're going to be creating more of these problems. Increased human population is important. Predictably, is impaired by the complexity of the vector-mediated system. I mean, if you have drug-resistant bacteria, it's much easier to know what to do than if you have something like a vector-borne system. Changes in disease agents, changes in the vectors, new vector-parasite interactions, and the changing environment are sort of making our life difficult. It's also making our life interesting. There are very beautiful novel ecological studies that are coming out as a response to trying to find ways of understanding how diseases are transmitted by vectors. novel evolutionary studies, detailed life history studies that I keep saying in the 1940s and 50s, they had it right. There were some beautiful, beautiful studies done at the time trying to understand, my experience, mosquitoes, but I'm sure that was also true of ticks and other disease vectors. Now we also have novel methods of control, with molecular biology being able to have some saying on all of this. And overall, we seem to have a nice broad discussion, cross-field, cross-interdisciplinary, that is allowing us to come up with better ways to comprehend and do something about vector-borne diseases. Now, beyond published manuscripts, there's a new journal, Parasites and Vectors, from Biomed Central. And you know, although I have a very nice library at Rutgers, this open access system is really nice. It just gives you all these papers immediately. The Parasites and Vectors is absorbing these kinetoplastid biology and diseases and filaria journal. So this just started this year. There's also a slew of new books. Medical Entomology for Students, fourth edition paperback by Mike Service is out this year. Emerging Pests and Vector-Borne Diseases in Europe, Ecology and Control of Vector-Borne Diseases. This is going to be part of a large series that I can't remember the name of the main group is putting together. So quite a few papers are going to be coming out of this in this field. Infectious Disease Ecology, Effects on Ecosystems on Disease and Disease on Ecosystems by Osfeld et al. Is also out. American Pests, The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times by James Williams is also out. James Williams is an historian. It's an interesting book. I'm almost done with it. And I'm almost done with The Six-Legged Soldiers by Jeff Lockwood. And don't have a large meal before reading this book. Finally, there's a large series of reviews, and thank you to all of you that write reviews, because it really is a lot of work, and it helps a lot. Things from Animal Bites and Stings to a really interesting review on the global perspective on epidemiology, the enigma of yellow fever in East Africa. And again, I didn't really talk about very much on a large amount of research being done on ecological immunology of mosquito-malaria interactions. And finally, Graham White said he would send me the paper, but he didn't. There is a new paper, Annual Review of Entomology, on the role of vector control in the global program to eliminate lymphatic filariases, that I'm very curious about. Thank you.